Welcome to the Global Research News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman, brought to you by globalresearch.ca. Just a word about the website. It relies, like all the others, like the website that my guest today is the editor of, it runs, it keeps going, it continues its mission with the help of those who read it, who visit it on a regular basis, who rely on it for the information that it provides. So we urge listeners to this program absolutely to visit the site and absolutely visit the one that my guest today is the editor of. We'll talk about that in a moment. And do support them. Your support is important because without it, these sites can't really operate as well. Venezuela Analysis, run by my guest today, Greg Wilpert, does get some support. GlobalResearch.ca gets no outside support except from its readers. So we urge you to do what you can and absolutely listen to this program. My guest today is Greg Wilpert. Greg runs the wonderful website, Venezuela Analysis. He lived in Venezuela for 8 years. He knows the country well. He's a PhD sociologist, a freelance journalist, a former U.S. Fulbright scholar in Venezuela, and he's the current editor of VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Oh, without question, it is the outstanding website to know what is going on in the country, to get the information straight and accurately. Completely the opposite of the way the Chavez government is characterized in the U.S. media. And I don't have to explain that to listeners of this program. They know it. They know the way Chavez is vilified. Oh, all of the terms of derision they use about him. It's because what he does is so effective. It simply shames the way U.S. governments run the country here, whether we're talking about foreign policy, domestic policy, you name it. And there's virtually not a dime's worth of difference whether Republicans run it or whether Democrats run it. I certainly don't see it. If anybody does and has the proof, please send it to me. I'd love to know about it, but I certainly don't see it. So we want to talk about Venezuela today, and we want to talk about a book that Greg wrote in the past couple of years. He calls it Changing Venezuela by Taking Power, the History and Policies of the Chavez Government. And for listeners who aren't familiar with it, oh, my goodness, we need to bring you up to date. So we'll do a little bit of that. Greg, welcome to the program. Oh, you're still trying to get him? well, he knows he's coming on. Let me give you a little background, and we'll break in a minute or so and then pick it up. But Chavez was elected in December 1998. Well, I've done a good deal of writing myself in Venezuela. December 98, took office in, I believe, February 1999. He initiated a brand new constitution. Oh, the other one was just atrocious. But they do things differently in Venezuela. They put these things to a national referendum. The people decided, did they want it or did they not want it? Well, they voted, 1999, they voted it, I believe it was in December. They voted thumbs up, overwhelmingly. Then there was a new election because the Constitution called for it in 2000. Chavez was reelected. Let's take a break, and we'll pick it up very briefly with a recap after that. And hopefully we'll have Greg on the line and we can continue. We'll be right back.
This is Castadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to the News Hour. I think I have Greg Wilpert on the line. Greg, are we connected?
Hi, yes, Steve.
Oh, yeah. Welcome to the program. I gave you a glorious introduction. I mentioned your book.
Thank you.
Oh, it's terrific having you back on again. I was just very briefly I think my listeners know that the way the Chavez government is portrayed in the major media here is considerably different than the way things really are in Venezuela. And you live there long enough to know. Is it perfect? Of course not. There's no perfection anywhere. But what goes on there compared to what goes on here is night and day. I was just giving listeners a brief synopsis of Venezuelan history since Chavez was elected in December 98. Let me just run through that very briefly. I left off after he was reelected in 2000 after the Constitution was overwhelmingly passed by referendum. There was the U.S. staged aborted two-day coup in April 2002. I hope I remember all the dates right. I was absolutely shocked and in pain for 2 days. But like Phoenix, he came back and resumed his position as the democratically elected president. Then the year end, there was year end 2002. Early 2003, there was an oil management lockout that cost the country, if I remember the numbers right, something on the order of about $15 billion. Again, you know, mischief cooked up by CIA, National Institute of Democracy, a subversive U.S. organization, others along with it. But Chavez survived. He was reelected most recently in December 2006. And Greg, I remember it just hit me. He won so impressively that I remember I wrote an article talking about that he won by a greater majority than any president in U.S. history. Footnote.
Or Venezuelan history.
In Venezuelan history too. Well, I thought readers would be impressed with U.S. history. I add a footnote. From 1820, James Monroe in 1820 ran nearly unopposed, got about 80% of the vote. But since then, all the U.S. landslides could not match what Chavez did. So, you know, people in this country call him a dictator, a strong man. I haven't heard Hitler used for a while, but we've heard that in the past too. Well, maybe Hitler realized his sins and he came back as a saint. But we want to talk what's going on right now, Greg, and you certainly are on it all the time. And what's most current that listeners really would want to know? And then we want to talk about your book also.
Well, the most current, I guess, probably is that the opposition is trying to gain some traction again. Of course, I mean, they're always trying, but I think the conflict between the government and the former elites of Venezuela is heating up again, and they're taking advantage of a number of different things. One of them is, of course, the fact that that in Venezuela, the crime issue is still a major issue on most people's minds. The Chavez government has been trying to crack down on that and also on corruption, and that has actually given the opposition, ironically, more momentum in the sense that that some of the people accused of corruption belong to the opposition. Not all, but some of them do, and so... So they're taking advantage of that as well. So there's been two very high-profile indictments recently, and of opposition leaders. Although one of them, I'm not sure if you can really call him an opposition leader, but still, people who are affiliated with the opposition. And that's probably some of the main issues right now. There's been a recent accusation that there's another coup in the works, although I don't know how serious that is. I'm kind of a little bit skeptical, but you never know.
Well, you do never know. There certainly have been past threats or suspicions of past threats. And didn't Chavez just cancel a trip to El Salvador because he was fearful of some mischief going on?
Yes, exactly. there was a question about whether there were opposition people trying to assassinate him while he was leaving for El Salvador, arriving using a surface-to-air missile to shoot down his plane or something like that. Yeah.
Go ahead. Oh, absolutely. Well, there is a history in the U.S., Greg, of foreign leaders being shot out of the sky. If there's a surface-to-air missile, you know what markings are on that missile. I mean, it absolutely would be made in the USA. And the most recent one that I remember was back in the early 1990s that triggered the Rwanda massacres, where the presidents of two countries were shot out of the sky in their plane. Presidents of Burundi and Rwanda were struck by a surface-to-air missile, blew the plane out of the sky, and that was used as a trigger to start all of the massacres that happened afterwards. I mean, the whole story gets a lot uglier than that, and the truths and so on. But that's a different topic. But I guess if they could do it there, they could do it most anywhere.
When the president is entering or leaving a country, on an airplane, that's probably one of the most vulnerable points because there's almost nothing you can really do to protect against an attack like that, since they're usually flying a passenger airplane that's relatively defenseless against an incoming missile. So it's certainly one of the easiest ways, if you have that kind of technology, to shoot down the president.
We sure as heck have that fucking technology, Greg, all over the world. And of course, the U.S. military is stationed all over the place. And, on land, on sea, they can fire these things from U.S. ships, military ships, wherever they're stationed. I mean, they're in the Western Hemisphere as well as others. So, I mean, they can do this stuff. This Chavez tried to, I wish he would do it all the time, simply not announce an upcoming trip and just take it unannounced.
Yeah, he's certainly done that before, definitely. But, some trips just, have to be announced in advance, such as this inauguration. People were expecting him to be there for the inauguration of the Salvadoran president, the first MLN president of El Salvador.
It really is shocking that a democratically elected leader can't function normally. It turns me red, Greg, to think about it, that people who decide that they want their country's sovereignty to be respected, they want to run their countries just the way the leadership of any other country has the right to run it, good, bad, or otherwise. No country has a right to tell another country how it should govern itself, even when it does it abysmally. It's their country. It's up to their own people to decide one way or the other about those things. Of course, the U.S. would never tolerate another country dictating to Washington.
Yeah, there's actually a very interesting study that was done recently that compared, the results of the Latino Barometer, which is this poll that is taken in all of Latin America about what people think of their governments and of democracy. And there's an extremely high correlation where people think highest of their democracy and are participating the most is precisely those countries where the U.S. government is complaining the most about the supposed lack of democracy in those countries, and those countries where people have the lowest regard for democracy and are the most critical of the government, of their own government, that's where the U.S. government is praising the functioning of democracy. I mean, for example, in Colombia or so.
Oh, absolutely. Well, Uribe, in Colombia, Washington's closest ally in the region, and he's nothing but a thug, a gangster, a killer. I mean, he's outrageous and corrupt and the whole works besides. There's one thing that interests me. The April Summit of the Americas that took place, apparently Obama did not get an overwhelming joyous greeting during the time he was down there. Was that your impression?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, one speaker after the other criticized the history of U.S. involvement in Latin America. And it was a real shame, though, that Obama, I think, you missed an opportunity there to acknowledge that history. But instead, what is it, rather than acknowledging it and taking responsibility for it in the sense of saying, yes, this was wrong, he just said that, you know, let's not dwell on the past. And that was like a slap in the face. You know, people thought, you know, he'd be somebody who's more understanding, but yeah, he just said, let's not dwell on the past, let's forget about it. But the fact is, you know, what Obama didn't seem to realize is that in order to move beyond the past, you have to acknowledge it, because otherwise people are going to continue to bring it up all the time.
Oh, absolutely, Greg. I guess you're on a cell phone, right?
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Well, I can hear you fine. There's a little static, but you're coming through loud and clear. Well, of course, he's done the same thing on up here on the issue of CIA torture, which is a major, major issue, and it's one I've certainly had an awful lot to say about and discuss on this program. And he simply whitewashes the whole thing and says exactly what you just said. We need to look ahead, not past. Well, malarkey, if you don't hold those who committed past crimes accountable, then we'll just keep committing them all over again. That music means we need to take a break, Greg. Let's do that, and we'll come right back.
Okay.
This is RVN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Greg Wilpert of VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Greg, I thought we could talk about your book in the second half of the program. We've got a short segment to a break at the bottom of the hour. But I know one thing that struck me so much about Venezuela when I wrote my first ever article about it and then continued in some others. I was so struck by the benefits, the social benefits, the participatory democracy and the social benefits that are actually written into the Constitution. I mean, that's impossible here in the U.S., absolutely impossible. And even the way our Constitution was crafted in the first place, there's more mythology about it than actual fact about what went on and who the people were who did it and so on and so forth. But that's a separate story. I need to have a program about that someday. But I mean, it really is astonishing. We're all Venezuelans get free education to the highest level, free health care. The needy get subsidized food, some help with housing, all sorts of other benefits that, again, are impossible here. We slowly strip away social benefits here, either directly or most often by stealth. Greg, I'm on Medicare. And I'm being stripped by stealth of my Medicare benefit by every year incrementally getting me to pay more and more for it in amounts greatly exceeding inflation. So they hit me with a new increase every year, and inflation may be whatever, 2%, 3%, and they hit me with an 18% increase.
Wow.
So that's stealth stealing my benefits. That's the way we do it here. But Chavez,
yeah,
of course, has used the nation's oil wealth to provide very, very generous benefits for Venezuelans. And the poverty was so great that when he was elected, and poverty is still an issue, but he's done so much to alleviate it. It's really incredible.
Yeah, well, the thing is, like you said, in Venezuela, the Constitution doesn't just guarantee political and civil rights, but it also guarantees economic and social rights. And that's something that most people aren't very aware of, the importance, obviously, of having economic and social rights, the rights to an education, to health care, to employment, and so on. And so that's why the government definitely sees itself committed to providing these things free of cost, because they are a right. And this is one of the interesting things also that, you know, human rights groups around the world are, you know, often criticizing the Chavez government. And I've spent a lot of time actually going into depth about pointing out how misguided and distorted these criticisms are. But one thing that they also forget completely is tremendous advances in the provision of economic and social rights in Venezuela.
Oh, and it really is incredible. I don't think it makes any difference if a country is big or small. Venezuela is less than 10% the size of the U.S. In population. And certainly in GDP, a small fraction of the U.S. I think it really is, Paul, a good governance versus bad governance. So we direct so much, even before the current economic crisis, where we're pouring trillions of dollars to bankers who caused the crisis in the first place, we spend so much money on militarism, and people don't realize, I've certainly mentioned it on this program a number of times, that you throw all categories into the pot on what we spend on so-called defense, foreign, domestic, the works, including homeland security and everything, excluding the black budgets that we don't know about, like CIA and NSA, and it greatly exceeds $1 trillion a year. It is absolutely astonishing. And, of course, we fight perpetual wars all over the place. And Venezuela doesn't do this. It uses its revenues productively as a small military. My God, I think our National Guard, we spend more money on our National Guard here than Venezuela spends on its military.
Right.
Because we're talking about 50 states. Probably a lot more than Venezuela spends on its military. And Venezuela doesn't invade its neighbors. Venezuela has a legitimate good neighbor policy with wonderful trade practices like ALBA and really having a system that benefits that countries can work together cooperatively and each can benefit, as opposed to destructive agreements like NAFTA and CAFTA that are a WTO. I mean one-way deals where the dominant countries benefit and they literally rip off the developing ones and the less dominant ones. What kind of a system is that? Well, that's not the Venezuelan way.
No, it's certainly a system that where the priorities are messed up. That's for sure.
Well, we want to talk about your book. We'll take a break in another minute or so. But I mentioned your book, Greg, titled Changing Venezuela by Taking Power, The History and Policies of the Chavez Government. Why did you write it?
Well, basically to counter the disinformation that exists in the U.S. media about Venezuela. I noticed over the years of reading, U.S. media reports on Venezuela, just how totally misguided they were and distorting, what was actually happening in Venezuela. And so I felt it was necessary to provide what in my eyes obviously was a more accurate account that actually, goes in, and is not uncritical. I mean, in my book, I am critical about several aspects, but, to take an objective look at what's happening.
Greg, we need to take another break. There's no question that there's no perfection in government anywhere, and at the same time, Chavez has been around for a little over a decade. He has generations of very vitally needed change to overcome.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Greg Wilpert of VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Greg, I'll let you explain it because you know it better than I do, but Chavez talks about building socialism for the 21st century and a participatory social democracy. You certainly cover this in the book. Explain that and how it's proceeding. And at the same time, I had another point that slipped my mind, but at the same time, private business gets along very well in Venezuela. And there was one other point I wanted to make as well. Let me just tuck it in and then you take over and describe Chavez's agenda the way you wrote about it in your book. But ever since back at the time of the 2002, late 2002, early 2003 oil management lockout, Venezuela has had steady growth even up to the most recent quarterly reporting period. It's come way down nearly to flat line, but world economies are just staggering for quarter after quarter during the current economic crisis. And Venezuela absolutely has been affected like most any other country. But so far, its growth is still positive, and business is certainly doing better in Venezuela than it's doing in most every Western country. Well, that alone says something about wanting to knock out the private sector and have government take over everything. I'm not certain that would be such a bad idea in a lot of respects. But talk about his socialism for the 21st century.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's basically an attempt to introduce socialism, but having learned the lessons of the 20th century, that is, not to pursue kind of the Soviet model of socialism, of state socialism, as it's sometimes known, but to have a kind of socialism that basically, you know, takes care of, gives equal importance, put it this way, puts equal importance on the economic and social rights as it does on political and civil rights, rather than prioritizing one over the other. One could say, so to speak, that the Soviet model prioritized economic and social rights over the political and civil rights. In other words, trying to guarantee everyone a work, a job, and free healthcare, and so on. But trampling essentially on people's political rights by limiting democracy. And in Venezuela, they're trying to have 21st century socialism, which would place equal emphasis on both sets of rights. And in other words, you know, making sure that these are kept. And one of the consequences, one of the things that this means in terms of building institutions, is that you cannot rely solely on the free market to provide people with, you know, education and healthcare and work, because the free market, as we know now, cannot provide all of these rights, at least not to the extent that is necessary. And so the state needs to participate, but it's not just that the state, but also that the idea is to open up opportunities for people themselves to enter into you know, relations of solidarity and to provide non-market solutions on a self-reliant basis. So, in other words, right now in Venezuela, they've introduced the communal councils, which is basically the building block for the participatory democracy, where the communal councils, in other words, the communities of 200 to 400 families, get together and figure out ways to solve their community's problems, with support, of course, from the central government, but with a tremendous amount of input from the communities themselves, instead of relying solely on the central government to provide the programs that they need. So if for example, you know, the healthcare program is being implemented in cooperation with the communal councils, or housing solutions are being implemented in cooperation with communal councils, and education programs, et cetera. And of course, you know, like you said, private enterprises still exist in Venezuela, and you know, for the foreseeable future, it will continue to exist. But there is the idea to amplify and to increase the importance and the role of what's known as the social economy, which is not necessarily a state-owned economy, which is also very important in Venezuela. But the social economy is those kinds of economic relations that are governed by economic democracy, that is, grassroots economic democracy, in other words, cooperatives and what are being called socialist enterprises, that is, enterprises which are not only worker-controlled, but also where the communities in which these enterprises operate, the communities participate in the governance of those enterprises and have a say in what is being produced and how much is going to be produced and so on. Since, you know, basically based on the principle that whoever is affected by the decisions should have a say in making those decisions. And so that's why community involvement is important, and not just the people who are working there. So in the future vision, so to speak, or at least the medium-term vision for Venezuela is to have an economy where the state-owned sector, the social economy of self-managed enterprises and community-managed enterprises and the private sector, all these three sectors have more or less an equal size in the economy. Right now, you know, the private economy is actually still larger than the other two. So the idea is to grow the other two so that they're more or less one-third in size each.
Well, balance.
So that's basically.
Go ahead, Greg. Right? Go ahead.
So that's basically the vision for 21st century socialism. I mean, that's in a nutshell. There's a lot more to it than what I just described, but I think a short description.
Oh, indeed, and I think you could use the term social democracy, and the idea of balance makes an awful lot of sense to me. I think a great indictment of what we refer to as a free market economy, what's been going on for the past couple of years now, if that doesn't point out the shortcomings of what we refer to as a free market economy, I don't know what does. The amount of suffering in certainly Western countries around the world, job losses, losses of homes through foreclosures, people losing their pensions, losing all sorts of rights. I mean, this is because of terrible, terrible policies, frankly, malicious, corrupt policies. If this isn't an indictment of what clearly does not work, and we need a different system that does work, the idea that government gets it wrong and the market gets it right, well, that is a great myth that we need to plunge a dagger through the heart of that myth and just get rid of it, because we see clearly that is not the case. When powerful interests run things to benefit themselves and they simply don't care about the majority in their countries, well, this is the outcome. And it's even worse in the U.S., Greg, than just looking at the last couple of years, or even since 2000, when the great bull market, bull stock market, came to an end with the dot-com crash. It really goes back the better part of 40 years, when the standard of living in the U.S. leveled off back in the 1970s, and it literally has been going down ever since. If you take a look at incomes in this country, Greg, adjusted for inflation, they have been on a steady decline for the better part of 40 years. Well, there is another very major indictment of the so-called free market system. I don't think this is bad in Europe, but they seem to get dragged along the same path that we are. And Japan has been in a terrible way for the last 20 years. I mean, something different needs to be done. And here Venezuela has had how many straight quarters of economic growth? The 20, 25 straight quarters?
22, I think.
22 straight quarters. I mean, that is awfully impressive. And we've had programs with different guests on this program, Greg, explaining how you could have a so-called free market system mixed in with important things run by the government. And there's one thing I wanted to bring up with you. The big one would be to have the central bank controlling the country's money supply. And if that were the case, we could have a much different situation than we have today. My understanding is that the central bank in Venezuela is still independent. Is that right?
Yes, technically that's true. Of course, Chavez has been able to appoint people who support him. And so therefore, I mean, it's still independent, but they do cooperate very closely with the government.
But one of the provisions in the referendum that went down a year and a half ago was to make it a government-run central bank. Isn't that right?
Right. Yes. I mean, basically, the idea being that the idea that the central bank has to be autonomous is something that is promoted essentially by neoliberalism. And actually, what happens in those situations is that the bank tends to follow those, you know, lobbies that it's closest to, which tends to be the private sector. And what it means is that there's a lack of democratic control over the money supply. And so the Chavez government did propose to basically eliminate the autonomy of the central government, central bank, and saying that, you know, it should be under democratic control.
What's the status of that now? Is there any effort being done to resurrect that? The idea
of that particular proposal, no. There have been other issues where that have been picked up again that had that didn't pass in that reform proposal. But that one about the central bank, no, because the only way to take it up is to change the Constitution, and there's just been too many other things going on to worry about that.
So if it happens, it might have to wait for another election, post another election.
Yeah, well, another constitutional reform amendment.
Yeah, they can only have one during if one goes down, you can't resurrect it again in a given presidential term, isn't that right?
Yeah, actually, in a given term of the National Assembly, and that ends in 2010. So in theory, after 2010, it could be resurrected.
It could come up again.
Although individual ideas could be picked up again, it's just that the whole package can't be repeated again.
Oh, that is one thing that I hope will happen, Greg. I think having a government-run central bank is so crucial, and you don't find it around very much. And when a country tries to do it, the powers in the West really come down hot on it. But here in the U.S., the U.S. Constitution says only the government has a right to use the term coin money, but print money. And it's just crazy that the government should be paying interest on its own money. Does Venezuela pay interest on its own money to private bankers?
That's a good question. I don't know. I assume so, but I don't really know.
I'll bet it does. And I would love to sit down with Chavez and say, you have to change this. You have to change this. You will solve all your economic problems. Let's talk more about your book, because you get more into it. You get into other issues. Well, you cover the history, and you cover the middle class that elected Chavez, and then because of what he's done to help the poor and disadvantaged in the country, they began to turn against him. But he still has a pretty significant majority. Is there anything beneath the surface that's weakening that in any way?
Well, of course, it depends on how the economic situation continues. That could weaken it. I think Chavez does have maybe 20% of the people that support him, maybe 20-25% of those support him because the economy is doing well. I don't think that's the case for everybody, because there have been times when Venezuela's before during the coup and the oil industry shut down where the economy tanked, and so there's a hard core of supporters who won't abandon Chavez no matter what. But there are some that would abandon him if the economy were to take a turn for the worse, and that's possible if, let's say, the price of oil were to drop again. I mean, it's been going up recently, and there's good reason to believe it will continue to stay up or go even more up. But if for some reason it were to drop again suddenly, that could present a serious problem for the Venezuelan economy, and then that would mean a loss of support of at least some of the more opportunistic supporters of Chavez that currently support him.
I know for a while it dropped below $40 a barrel, but in the 30s.
Right.
And just recently it went up to $70 or more. If the economy stays strong enough, then the price would be higher. It just strikes me as illogical that it would be this high, Greg. I hope it's high enough to keep things going well in Venezuela. But it seems my sense is that the economy is anything but strong. And the discussions that we've had on this program pretty much look forward to a very long, a dark period ahead of economic weakness and an awful lot of duress. So it's hard to imagine that things would be rising in value because of growing demand. So the price of oil may have gone up, but it could just as easily turn around and go back down again. Who knows?
Right. Exactly. It really depends on how that goes, I think. But I think, like I said, I think Chavez still will enjoy a lot of support because people do feel like, he represents them, even if the economy takes a turn for the worse, even if there were a recession in Venezuela. I think he could even then get reelected in 2012.
He's still directing a very substantial portion of the budget towards social benefits. So even though the revenue fell off, he's doing all he can, and I guess he's maintaining essential stuff.
Yes, I mean all of the social programs that existed before this economic crisis hit are being maintained. The cutbacks have been happening mostly, I think, in military spending and in perhaps in some forms of infrastructure investment, perhaps. But by and large, and then also what they're calling unnecessary spending. That is, there've been cutbacks in the top wages of all the state managers. They've had to actually take a 20% hit on their salaries. That is for the top level managers who've been earning extraordinary salaries. They certainly can afford it. So there've been a lot of cutbacks, but they've been all in areas that are non-essential and that don't affect more needy sectors of the population.
At the same time, he's gotten through minimum wage increases for the people in most need, and Venezuela has a bit of an inflation problem. So getting that minimum wage up is important, at least to keep pace with inflation.
Exactly.
I'm not sure he's doing it.
The minimum wage has been keeping pace with the inflation.
Has been keeping pace. Well, I guess that's the reason he's doing it then. Greg, let's take another break, and we'll come back, and let me let you highlight whatever else is important and whatever else in your book you'd want to bring out in the last few minutes we have left. We'll be right back.
This is RBN, the Republic Broadcasting Network.
Welcome back to the News Hour. On with Greg Wilpert of VenezuelaAnalysis.com. And Greg, the book is titled again, Changing Venezuela by Taking Power, the History and Policies of the Chavez Government. And you can go to VenezuelaAnalysis.com. You can get information on the book. And, I strongly recommend you bookmark the site. Of course, bookmark globalresearch.ca. You've already done that if you're listening to this program, I'm sure. But for absolutely a wealth of information, good information, accurate information on Venezuela, the place to find it is VenezuelaAnalysis.com. And, Greg, you deserve the credit for the great website that you put together. It really is a treasure trove, and my hat's off to you for it. You've encouraged me to discover more and more about Venezuela. And to wish we had some of the things here that are going on down there. But in your book, you cover a lot of ground. You cover the government. You cover economic policy, social, foreign policies, constitutional reform, the good, the bad, the in-between, the opportunities, the obstacles. Oh, how can you sum it up from what you wrote about and what you see going on?
Oh, that's pretty difficult.
It's 25 words or less. Well, a few more than that.
Well, I mean, I would say that to sum it up, I would say that Venezuela is, I think, determined to try to build an alternative to free market capitalism that is viable and that isn't just relying on, so to speak, welfare state. It goes beyond the welfare state in the sense that it tries to also introduce participatory democracy that is more responsive to people's needs and is less paternalistic in that sense. And so I think that's a very important element. So it's really going in a new direction in that sense. It's not just a repeat of, the kind of European or even the U.S. kind of welfare state mechanisms of the limited forms that exist in the United States. So it's in that sense, it's very innovative and a very important lesson, I think, for the world. And one of the reasons I actually called it, changing Venezuela by taking power is because there was, there's this idea out there. Somebody wrote a book called Change the World Without Taking Power. And it's kind of a very popular amongst progressive circles, which is this idea that we can change the world without taking power, that state power is, a source of corruption, and therefore we should ignore the state and just focus on, building, communities or something like that that are creating an alternative. But I think the lesson of Venezuela is specifically that you can create real change by focusing on the state, and that's very important because the state is one of the is precisely one of the areas that has in the past been used to repress social movements, and by having social movements actually controlling the state, which I would say is to some extent the case in Venezuela, it opens the space for social movements and for participation to a much greater degree than otherwise would be possible. And so that's why people who believe in progressive social change cannot ignore the importance of the state in achieving change. Of course, and the other element that I bring up in my book that I think is important to keep in mind is, of course, not everything, the whole process in Venezuela is not guaranteed. It's not a foregone conclusion. It's still very much a process in the making, and there's still some important obstacles that I bring up towards the end of my book. One of them is that, the dependence of this process on Chavez is one, is a bit of a problem.
Oh, indeed. He's been very I've got to stop you because they're going to break away.
Yeah.
Oh, I hate to do that. I always hate to do that. They're about to cut off. Oh, my great thanks, Greg, for coming on. You've got to come back, and we'll continue this with more about Venezuela again.